Okay, I think we're ready to kick off this session. Today we have two speakers who will describe the practice of social marketing and explain how it can be and has been applied to watershed issues. The first speaker will be Charlie McPherson, who is with Tetra Tech. Charlie has incorporated social marketing principles into watershed management activities for the past 15 years. She has developed handbooks, conducted trainings, and facilitated work groups to assist organizations to effectively change behaviors to improve the environment. Charlie will be followed by Chris Connor, Director of Communications for the Chesapeake Bay Program, the federal-state partnership guiding the restoration of the nation's largest estuary. His work focuses on engaging Chesapeake Bay watershed residents about personal stewardship and environmental protection efforts through community outreach, stakeholder relations, and scientific communications programs. Chris will tell us about the Chesapeake Club campaign, developed to change behaviors in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We have an exciting presentation today, so let's get started. I'll now turn the microphone over to Charlie McPherson. Good afternoon, Charlie.
Thanks, Ron. Hello, everyone out there. Now, Ron mentioned that I've been doing this for 15 years in watershed situations, but I think my real experience comes from working every day with my 15-year-old son and 16-year-old daughter, trying to get them to change their behaviors. This includes picking up towels off the floor, refilling the ice trays. What is with that? Turning lights off. It's never ending. So hopefully you will pick up some techniques today that you can apply in your home situation. And if any of them do work, I would love to hear back from you all. Now, moving into the presentation, I want you all to think for a minute of how we are bombarded every day with messages that try to get us to change our behaviors. And think about some of the techniques that are used to influence these choices. Maybe it's to get us to switch brands of detergent so our clothes will be whiter. Or maybe if we drink a certain type of beer, we will be wildly attractive to the opposite sex. Or maybe if we serve a certain type of fish sticks to our children, we will be better mothers because we are giving them nutritious meal while they just think the rectangular breaded blocks of fish taste good. Now, these are all examples of different marketing techniques used to influence our behavior that will make us buy their product. So what if we use these same principles and applied them to social issues, such as public health, safety, or the environment? This is called social marketing, and that's exactly what we're going to talk about for the next 2 hours, showing you how you can use these techniques to get various audiences to voluntarily change their behaviors that will ultimately improve the environment. So if we move on to the second slide, I have a definition of social marketing. I just want to read to you all. What is social marketing? It's using marketing principles and techniques to influence a target audience to voluntarily change a behavior for the benefit of individuals, groups, or society as a whole. Now, there are two key phrases that I want you to pay attention to here. The first one is target audience. It's influencing a target audience, so we need to specify an audience. The second thing is the voluntarily change. So social marketing involves voluntary change. And so we'll be talking about that more later. Now, moving on to slide 3, why is social marketing important? Well, frankly, knowledge is not enough. We know a lot of things, but if we don't act on it, it doesn't do any good. Now, I want to ask you all out there, and you're on the honor system. Raise your hands if you know smoking is bad for you. Come on. Okay. Everyone raise their hands. Excellent. Now, raise your hand if you're a smoker. Okay. See? Knowledge is not enough. You know it's bad for you, but still we engage in some of these behaviors. This is why we want to use social marketing. There'll be some quizzes later on, too. Now, moving on to slide 4, here are some common social issues that I think everyone is familiar with that use the social marketing principles. I think the most common is for public health. I just mentioned not smoking. Exercising. We see these campaigns to help reduce obesity. Getting regular checkups, preventive medicine. Public safety. Social marketing's been used for years to get us to wear our seatbelts. And now we see it increasingly with motorcycle helmets. Moving on to slide 5, in environmental issues, this is a relatively new field of using social marketing, but and some of the issues that we would try to tackle would be, for example, water conservation, trying to get people to turn off the faucet when they're brushing their teeth, use less water. And certainly the second point, non-point source pollution or polluted runoff, is where we're using social marketing a lot, where these are voluntary behavior change. We're trying to get people to pick up their pet waste, to use the appropriate amount of fertilizers on their lawn, to reduce the amount of bare spots that create erosion. Recycling, I think, is much more common. If you think about it, we've had recycling campaigns for, what, 25, 30 years, and we're still trying to get people to recycle. So this is not a one-shot deal. Social marketing, in order to get that behavior change, has to be repeated over and over and over. Now, moving to slide 6, I want to show an example of a very old environmental campaign, the Keep America Beautiful campaign. This was first aired in 1971. If you look at the message, this is people start pollution, people can stop it. This is showing that you have the ability, you're empowered to control this, that you can stop the littering. I think this would be similar to sort of the Nike, you know, campaign today. Just do it. Moving on to slide 7, I want to show why this is not a one-shot deal for social marketing. You start in the bottom left rectangle with knowledge, but there's several steps that we have to move through in order to get behavior change. So we first have to make people aware of the issue and what they can do. We have to get them motivated as to why they should do this. And then perhaps we have to give them skills. They may be motivated, but they don't have the skills necessarily to execute it. Then it becomes a habit. Once it becomes a habit, you will see behavior change. So there's several steps that we have to go through. Now, moving on to number 8. There are two key points I want to cover in my section today. The first is the know your audience. As I mentioned in the definition of social marketing, it involves focusing on a target audience. And so you've got to do the research on that audience and know that audience in order to craft messages that are going to be receptive to that audience. The second key point is in the message itself, keeping it simple, promoting very simple behaviors that people can understand and are easy and communicated in a way that people get very quickly. And I'll be showing examples of all of these. But if you kind of think of some messages from different social marketing campaigns as far as simple actions, turn the water off when you brush your teeth, keep the thermostat down, replace smoke detector batteries every Halloween, you know, very simple, clear actions. So, and that's very difficult to do, actually. Moving on to slide 9. So the first point is knowing your audience. And this is where I think this is the most important step and often the step that is just ignored, because either we make the assumption that, well, we know our audience and we know what they care about, or we think it's too expensive to do the research, and so we move on to crafting the message. And frankly, if you don't do this step, it's really not worth going on. In terms of knowing your audience, you want to first target the markets, your audience, that are most ready to act. Picking the low-hanging fruit, the ones most receptive. And then for that audience, you want to identify both the benefits for that audience in changing the behavior and potential barriers that would prevent them from changing their behaviors. Because in lots of instances, there may be, they see the benefit, but the barriers are greater, so they're still not willing to act. And so we need to identify what those barriers are and figure out ways to overcome them. We need to give them something in return, an exchange, if they are willing to adopt the behavior that we're asking them to. We have to give them something in return. So let's see what some of these benefits might be. Moving on to slide 10. They could be real benefits, such as saving money, and that usually gets people's interest. If you leave your grass clippings on your lawn, you're going to save money because you won't need to fertilize. Saving time. Time and money with the grass clipping issue. Protecting health. Obviously, if you stop smoking, you're going to improve your health. But that may not work for some. That's not going to work for the tough ones. If you eat less and exercise more, it'll improve your health. Or there can be perceived benefits. And this is where the social marketing really comes into play in behavior change. It's most often used for the perceived benefits. Fitting in with others, that if you do this, it's cool. Now, again, I use my 15-year-old son, Fraser, and as an example. He has the most disgusting sort of mesh woven neon green basketball sneakers, sort of with a zipper kind of molded, and they cost a fortune, and he paid for them, but he fit in with all his other peers who have them because it's cool. So you can't underestimate the power of that. So we have to figure out how we make some of our behaviors that we want them to do cool, which is challenging, particularly for pet waste. Other benefits, people expect it, and we'll be talking more about this, sort of the social norms. Not putting your newspapers in your trash can. People expect that you will recycle your newspapers now, and I think that is now an expectation, which is great. Same with recycling. So we want to get some of these other actions at that level. Everyone else is doing it, so you're the odd man out if you're not. As well as other benefits, you'll get rewarded. You know, you'll get either an award if you do this, or you'll get a monetary, you know, coupon, something like that. Moving on to 11. Those are some of the benefits, but what are some of the barriers that we've seen to behavior change? Well, the first set are the physical barriers that people feel it's either too hard to do, which you're asking, or it's not safe. I don't want to go down to this stream and do water quality sampling. I don't feel it's safe. Or it takes too long. You know, people are willing to do a lot of this stuff as long as it is convenient for them. That's unfortunately the reality. In addition to physical barriers, there are the economic barriers, you know, added costs. Think of halogen light bulbs And, you know, they have to buck the trend there because, yeah, they do cost more. And so what will it take to say, you know, try this for 3 months and you'll see the difference? But that is a significant barrier. Or maybe they don't see any cost savings. You know, if it's the same amount of money, I like these round bulbs because frankly, my lampshades fit better on the round bulbs. That's a barrier for me. I don't like with those new halogen bulbs. Or, you know, no one else is doing it. That's, again, the sort of the social norm. They don't want to be perceived as being different. Moving on to 12 other barriers, and I didn't mean to make the barriers longer than the benefits, but that, I guess, too, is the reality. The educational barriers, that they don't, it's too technical, they don't know how to do it. And I was thinking in terms of the soil test kits, you know, getting people to test their soil. Do they really need to add fertilizers? Well, you know, soil testing sounds hard, sounds complicated. I didn't do, you know, take science in class. So how do you overcome that barrier? And then, of course, these social psychological barriers. This is the, you know, no one else is doing it. I don't see anyone else picking up, you know, their dog do. And I'm the only person in the park doing it. I look like a dork, you know. I don't want to be the only one. Or I've never done this before. You know, you're telling me to wash my car on the lawn so the water, you know, goes into the ground instead of running off into the street. Well, no one else does that. Or maybe they've tried it once and it didn't work. You know, they tried to recycle their motor oil and it just went all over the place, or they went to the recycling station, it was closed. I'm not going to do it again. Lots of barriers, as I think is the take-home message. But, and this is why we need to do the research with the audience to find out why they are not doing these behaviors. So, moving to slide 13, we need to overcome these barriers in our messages to help get our audience to adopt the behaviors we're looking for. So the easy one first is to show, well, in fact, everyone else is doing it. You're not the only one picking up pet waste. 90% of your, you know, this neighborhood picks up pet waste. Great. Or conversely, they're not doing it. People, you know, no one puts their newspapers in their trash. Show them that we will provide training. We'll teach you how to do it, how to do. We'll come out and give you a free soil test kit, and we'll show you how to do it in 5 minutes or less. No experience necessary. Oh, okay, well, that's great. Well, then I'll do it then. Show them how they're going to save money. Show them how much money they're going to save. If you can give them a time span to say, if you know, try this for 1 month or 2 months, a set time frame, people are more likely to say, okay, I'll give it 2 months and see if my water bill, you know, is less, if I, you know, put these low-flow toilets in. The reward, you know, either a rebate or something if you do this is often, and we'll talk about some of these tools later in terms of incentives, is enough to get someone to start the behavior change and say, okay, you know, I get $20 off on a new toilet, something like that. Moving to 14. Now, I mentioned about the need for audience research, that there's no way you can figure out what your audience feels or cares about or their attitudes unless you do some research. There are two types of research you can do. The first is using existing data as a starting point. There have been so many surveys and polls done at the national level that you can use to get a start, a baseline. Okay, nationally, this tends to be, you know, what we see in terms of attitudes, knowledge on environmental issues and such. Trade associations in your area do a lot of marketing research on the demographics and population. You can try to get hold of that data. But really, you need to go that next level down and conduct original research. And so I would recommend start with some of the national to get a feel, but you need to reach out to a subset of your target audience, be it through focus groups, interviews, telephone surveys, some means, and Chris Connor will talk about some of the research they did for Chesapeake Club, in order to get that information that feeds into the social marketing campaign. Because what if you don't? Well, let's move on to slide 15. This was a telephone survey we did in Tampa for residents, and 81%, we surveyed, I think, 460 households for a watershed education campaign, 81% of the respondents said they either didn't know or they did not, in fact, live in a watershed, which is pretty scary. So that showed us where we needed to start in terms of our education campaign. Now, moving on to 16, we need to figure out what will motivate our audience to change. And I've mentioned some of these, whether it's money, prestige, guilt is always good. I think the Keep America Beautiful campaign, frankly, was kind of the guilt. Ironize Cody with his, you know, that tear. Who didn't feel badly about that tear? My gosh. And moving to 17, if you don't know where to start in terms of with the messages, this is based on national data, national research called the three H's that people tend to care about: their health, their children's health in particular, their home in terms of property values, flooding, things like that, and heritage. They care about leaving something in place for future generations. Now, again, this is just a generality, but it's a good place to start if you don't know where. Now, I want to show you a couple examples of messages and how they change in response to different external factors. On slide 18, I know we've all seen this, 55 saves lives. Now, what is the message they're using here? Anyone? Okay, good. Save lives, public safety, right? Well, a few weeks ago, I was driving on the Beltway, and I saw this on slide 19. Lower speeds saves gas. Now, what's the message here? Come on, I want to hear you say it. It's an economic, right? It's going to save money. So they're not talking about saving lives, but go slower so you'll save gas. It's a different message because of different external factors. Now, moving on to slide 20, here's an example showing how you can use multiple messages to achieve the same objective. This we've seen, click it or ticket. Now, this is not a voluntary change, but we're saying basically if you don't wear your seatbelt, you're going to get a ticket. Or a different approach on slide 21, showing here seatbelt use last week, 85%. So this basically is saying that if you're part of that 85%, thank you very much and you guys are doing a great job. If you're part of that 15%, don't you want to be part of the 85 and help us try to get closer to 100%? So it's important to match your message to the audience. So on slide 22, we have a little quiz here. Audience on the left, message on the right. Let's take teenage girls. This is all to quit smoking. But you see, we have different messages depending on our audience because you can't go with one message. So teenage girls, what do they care about? That's right, yellow teeth. Want yellow teeth? Keep smoking. My daughter also says it makes your clothes smell bad, so they may want to incorporate that into their campaign. Whereas my 15-year-old with the neon shoes, teenage boys, the message is, you're bright enough to learn 40 football plays, and you're still smoking. Now, my target audience at home actually didn't really get that one. He just says it's stupid because you die. So that's another message for anti-smoking. So if you move on to 23, you can see the correct answers, but it just shows that you need to segment your audience down to a level so that you can go out with one message. Now, the second part is on slide 24. I mentioned the target audience. The second part is I mentioned the keep it simple. We need to promote simple behaviors that people can act on quickly. We can't go through too many steps. We may need to make it easy, and we need for them to see a result. And that's very challenging in the environmental field. But they need to see the benefit quickly. And so we accomplish this using different tools and techniques, which I'll go into in the next segment. But I think right now we're going to stop for a sec and take some questions from the studio audience. Ron?
Great. Thanks, Charlie, for that great introduction to social marketing. We are on slide number 25, which is our first question slide. As promised, we will have several question and answer periods. And we have received several emails from folks participating online, and we'll start with those. First one, and actually we've had a couple of emails to this effect, but Willa from North Carolina wants to know, Charlie, where are the best places to get national surveys?
Hi, Willa. That's a great question. And actually, Don Way with EPA's Non-Point Source Control Branch has developed a digital outreach toolbox in which there are dozens of surveys that are available. And so if you contact Don, I'm going to give you his email. It's Way, W-A-Y-E, dot Don, at epa.gov, and he'll be able to provide whatever you want.
Great, thanks, Charlie. We're also hearing from Barb in Minnesota. Sorry, I had my acronyms messed up there. Barb wants to know, do you have a bibliography of available data that describes barriers for various audiences?
That's an interesting question, not specifically because each audience is so different that you really can't generalize, and that tends to be the problem that we do generalize. And we say, okay, farmers think this, or motorcycle gangs think that. Well, maybe we can generalize with motorcycle gangs, but no. And that's why doing focus groups really, I think, I like to do, because I like to have that personal contact with them and actually use the focus group participants later on in the campaign, reviewing the materials to kind of ground truth. So I, unfortunately, I don't think there is an easy answer there.
And I invite any motorcycle gang members to chime in at your convenience. We'd love to hear from you. At this point, I'm going to unmute the phones and see if there are any questions out there from the hinterlands. If you have a question, please identify yourself, and when acknowledged, ask your question, please. Anybody out there with a question? Okay.
This is the city of Denver.
Yes, go ahead, Denver.
We were wondering if you have any metrics for to measure success.
Hi, Denver.
Hi.
You mean evaluation tools?
Yeah.
Okay, well that is actually, EPA is developing now, social indicators, which would help you measure that. And I can put you in touch with, Tom Davenport. Do you know him?
I do.
Yeah. See, I knew everyone did.
I'm an EPA employee on loan to the city, so.
Oh, you are? Oh, okay. But they're doing some stuff now with University of Wisconsin Extension, developing those indicators, which definitely would be used for evaluation of success.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Great. We have time for one more question from the phone lines. Okay, with no questions, let us continue with the presentation. We'll now move on to slide number 26, and Charlie will talk to us about the various tools available for changing behaviors.
Okay, thanks, Ron. So we've talked about the benefits and the barriers, and we know we need to focus down on our target audience. And what I want to do now is to identify some of the tools and techniques that we can use to help change these behaviors. And I've listed them out here, and I'm going to go through each one. We've got social norms, commitments, prompts, incentives, tangible actions, vivid communication, and building motivation. So moving on to slide 27, sorry. The social norms, and this is where I've touched on before, that people want, in general, to be perceived as normal, in general, I say, and doing behaviors that are expected. Now, this is why in the grocery store, in the hair coloring section, which maybe not all of us have been in, but I have. This is why we find hair dye that is typically black, brown, red, or blonde. You do see the pinks and occasionally the blues, but that's unusual because people want hair color, you know, that is perceived to be normal. Now, even if we think of our motorcycle gang members with the black leather and the studs and spiky hair and body piercing tattoos, they have their own social norm because they all tend to look the same within their grouping. So what we want to try to do is show people that the behavior we are asking them to do, to either change, to either do it or not to do it, everyone else is also doing it. So they are actually the outsider. So for example, if we move on to slide 28, this is a billboard at Michigan State University. I don't know if we have anyone here from MSU on the line. I'd love to hear from you. But it says 80% of MSU students use a designated driver. Do you? So what is this trying to show to everyone at the football game? That's right. That basically everyone uses a designated driver. So you're not considered a nerd or, oh gosh, you're not drinking tonight. Everyone uses a designated driver. So you're incredibly irresponsible if you don't. So that's kind of what we want to promote with some of our other techniques. Now moving on to 29, commitments. I like commitments a lot. Research has shown, and think of yourself, that if you make a verbal commitment to someone, you are much more likely to follow through because we like to be perceived as following through on what we say we're going to do, unless you're a parent, and it doesn't count for that. Because you do it because I say so. If you get a written commitment, there's an even higher likelihood that you will follow through. So think of when the blood drive calls you. Hi, Charlie, can we count on you to come on down on Sunday? Oh, yeah, sure, absolutely. Well, you kind of, oh, geez, I said I would go. Then if they follow up and call you again the day before, you're gonna go. I got a pledge in the mail yesterday for $10 to the hospital foundation, of which I did not pledge, but someone in my family did. I wrote the check because I thought, oh geez, I'm on record somewhere that I'm, you know, giving $10. People want to be perceived as following through. Same with signing up, petitions, signing your name. So how can we use this in our environmental campaigns? Well, this Take Shelley's Watershed Pledge, we did, it's an online pledge. People print it out and they do it with their families. that they will pledge to adopt these environmentally friendly practices. Now, another example on slide 30, this was the Residential Conservation Assistance Program, where basically RECAP came out and they give free home tours, and they will identify where you can save money in terms of energy and water. You know, put the insulation around your hot water heater, check a leaky toilet. And then they make a list, and the residents commit to carrying out the list of repairs that they've helped to prepare. Now, I'd be curious to follow up on this, that do they go back in 3 months to see if this has actually been done. Moving on to slide 31, prompts. Prompts are very good. We need those reminders. You know, generally we're all well-meaning, but we need those reminders of where we are to change our behaviors. And so you want to place the reminders or the prompts at what they call the point of sale or where you want the behavior change to take place. So, for example, if you don't want people to dump anything down your storm drain, put the sign on the storm drain, right? If you have it on the bulletin board in the grocery store, it's not going to do a lot of good. Now, you think of with the pet waste, you've got the signs at the dog park, right? And you've got the baggies, you know, there. So it's at the point of sale. Pick up, oh, right, you know. Moving on to 32, here's an example called Get in the Loop, Buy Recycled. So this is interesting because it's a reminder, but it's also that initial awareness. So it's what they call a shelf talker placed near the products that have recycled content to encourage customers to purchase recycled products. I would bet most people going there would go, oh, really? That's recycled? Oh, terrific. So it's both a reminder and probably that initial awareness tool. A final kind of prompt example on slide 33. This is showing, these are little stickers. This is not actual size. These are little 1-inch stickers that you peel off and you put on your faucet, so that it reminds you every time you've got that faucet on and you're brushing your teeth, it tells you a simple message. Turn off the water when you're brushing your teeth, for crying out loud, they should add. So it's the prompt at the point of sale. Another tool, moving on to 34, incentives. We all like to get something for nothing. Everyone does. So money is obviously a good incentive. There's very few cash awards, but you can think of rebates is basically like getting money, or giving away something for free is quite the incentive. Recognition is also an incentive. By rewarding positive behavior. If you see someone doing something right, we so often just punish the bad people. And again, as a parent, I'm accused for this. But if they're doing something right, you know, reward them. Give them an award, and through media coverage or something. All different kinds of audiences, elected officials, builders, contractors, etc. Excuse me. There's also sort of the disincentives, which still encourages voluntary behavior change. For example, in the city of Seattle, they started taking away the recycled garbage for free, but they charged per bag for your trash. It was still voluntary, but it was an incredible disincentive to have trash as opposed to recycled, which I thought was great. The incentives for the giving away free stuff, this is where if I were part of the halogen light bulb program, I would give away, you know, a free light bulb, because I think once that person used that light bulb, they would be hooked, and then they would see the benefit and be willing to shell out the money. That would probably help you over that initial barrier. So let's look at some examples on slide 35. City of Albuquerque, problem, which I'm sure doesn't exist anywhere else in the U.S., not enough water. Water conservation is their goal. And they were going to promote through incentives using rebates and rewards. So they gave incentives for both xeriscaping. If you put in a xeriscaped lawn, meaning it didn't need any water, native plants, you got a rebate, or installed a low-flow toilet, low-flow washing machine. So what were the results? Let's take a look on slide 36. Well, this was over a two-year period. They created 1,400 xeriscape lawns, converted 44,000 toilets and washing machines, and their bottom line, this is for residential users, their water use dropped 30%, saving 88 billion gallons. So that was tremendously successful. Another example, using incentives, on slide 37 in Oregon, where they had some air quality problems, and the air quality did not meet EPA standards, so their goal, to reduce air pollution. So how are they going to do that? Well, on slide 38, using incentives. So for consumers, two different audiences, consumers were given discount coupons on products that were very air quality friendly, and giving rebates for lawnmowers that were not high polluting lawnmowers. And for the businesses who cooperated, they could redeem their coupon there. At these businesses, they got free advertising, and here's the reward or award. They got a certificate of appreciation from the governor. Now, this, you can't underestimate this. People like, they have what's called the Love Me Wall, and this is important. So other businesses would want to have this as well. The results that they voluntarily attained EPA standards for carbon monoxide and smog. So moving on to slide 39. I mentioned earlier the need to keep it simple. Simple, clear messages of actions that people can take to change their behaviors. So this was a campaign called Get Green, and this was done by the National Ag Council. Problem, and this is what we face, excuse me, all the time. People don't know, so lack of awareness, how to help the environment. They don't know what to do. It's overwhelming. Or they're afraid it will take too much time or money. So this problem they identified based on research, audience research. So that was the barrier. You flip it around for the benefit. They developed quick tips that were easy, so people didn't have to change their lifestyle very much. It had a positive impact on the environment, and it saved money. So obviously the Get Green. And what were some of their messages? Let's see on slide 40. The formats they used, TV, radio, PSAs. So their messages, very simple, concrete things. Turn the thermostat down. You can get money for recycling your things. Keep your tires properly inflated, because that reduces not only wear and tear on the tires, but also you get better mileage. And keep your car properly tuned. Moving on to slide 41, vivid communication. And Chris is going to have some great examples of this in a minute. If you know, we're bombarded with these messages every day, and so you have got to reach them very quickly. And the one I love on the lower right here, your heart needs exercise, use the stairs. How simple is that? Use the stairs. Okay, if you don't work on the 29th floor. Moving on to slide 42. Here's some environmental campaign examples that I just want to end with. Texas CEQ non-point source pollution campaign. Key issues, which I think we're all familiar with, yard care, household hazardous waste, pet waste, motor oil. Their message, their simple message was, please don't feed the storm drain. So they didn't talk necessarily about all the pet waste, motor oil. Don't feed the storm drain. Nothing goes in the storm drain. Techniques, very vivid communication. If we move on to slide 43, hard to get more vivid than this. Very clear. Now on slide 44, the Las Vegas ad campaign, their problem, similar issues, Lake Mead, drinking water source. The techniques they used prompts at the point of sale, so markers on the storm drain, vivid communication through posters, PSA, and they built motivation over time. As I mentioned, this is not a one-shot deal. That in order to get this behavior change, it has to be repeated, in most cases, for years. And just, and you also have to use a combination of these techniques. Usually one, just one, is not going to work. If we take a look at number 45, pet waste is always good for vivid communication. Do your duty, protect the environment, pick up after your pet. Now, I want to just give, I have another target audience at home, my husband, who is very not environmentally friendly, unfortunately, but he does walk our dog every day, and we do have an ordinance, a pet waste ordinance in our town, and we do have doggy bags and signs at the point of sale, and none of those made any difference to him in terms of picking up after Zeke. The thing that did make a difference was an extremely annoyed woman who came up to him and, you know, shouted at him. And that was about 3 years ago and to this day. So peer pressure, you cannot underestimate the power of that. But that worked very well. So you have to use a variety of techniques because you just don't know which one. Well, he's not an early adopter, so he's not the low-hanging fruit we're going for. Now, moving on to 26, I want to keep hitting this home that knowledge is not enough. We know a lot about this stuff, and knowledge is not enough. Now, I want to give you an example to show you why this is true. Moving to slide 47, Got Milk campaign. How many people here, raise your hands, if you've heard of this campaign? Come on, Ron. 100%. Okay. Everyone's heard of this. So, based on that, and this actually goes to the metrics the woman was asking about earlier from Denver. Would you say this was a successful campaign? Well, what was the objective of this campaign? I've got time. I can wait. Okay, right. To sell milk. So did they meet their objective to sell more milk? Moving on to slide 48, this is the Academy of Education Development did this analysis, and you can see when they started the campaign in 94, tremendous awareness. Yes, everyone, you know, knew from Whoopi Goldberg to Elizabeth Hurley. And who doesn't want to look like Elizabeth Hurley? So if I drink milk, I'll look like her. But you look at the consumption of milk, which is that green flat line, for the next 6 years, completely flat. So despite the awareness and the media coverage, the consumption of milk did not go up. Now, why is that? Okay, I'm going to help you out. Two primary reasons. Because, and this goes back to the traditional marketing principles, which is the placement. They needed the placement of milk to be convenient. And if you think about it, you know, a soft drink or soda machine is right there. Milk, you had to go to the grocery store. So even if you were inclined to drink milk, it was not that accessible. The other thing was that milk wasn't, even though they made it cool, you know, if these baseball players were drinking it, that red and white carton was not very cool. So since then, they've redesigned the packaging to look more like Fraser's molded woven sneakers, and they're neon and kind of fun-looking for kids. So since they did that, the milk sales have gone up, but that's why it's so important to evaluate your campaigns. So that, moving on to slide 49, which is my last slide, I want to reiterate that we start with knowledge. You can't go out with a one-time message, even if it's incredibly funny and captures people. You've got to move from the knowledge, awareness. You've got to find out what motivates people and craft your message around that. Give them skills if needed. It can be technical assistance, whatever, to help overcome those barriers. So it becomes a habit. Once it becomes a habit, you will have behavior change. Now, we did a workshop this past week in Utah, and I asked people, why do you wear your seatbelts? So I want you to think about, why do you wear seatbelts? Now, Stuart Lehman of EPA said that because it's cool. And I would argue that Stuart's the only one who thinks wearing seatbelts cool, but that's great if he thinks it's cool, and that gets him to wear a seatbelt. But why? Think of why you wear your seatbelt. And we got the gamut. Someone said to me, because it's a habit. Well, how did it become a habit? Your parents nagging you? I won't start the car unless my, you know, oh, Mom, you know. Or is it that really annoying ding, 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 ding? That's what gets my husband to finally put it on, and we're all going crazy. That's a prompt at the point of sale. So different techniques work for different people. Okay, well, that's all I have, and thank you very much. And I guess we're going to open it up for some questions before moving on to Chris.
Thanks, Charlie. As Charlie mentioned, we're now at our second question and answer period, slide 50. We'll take some questions that were submitted online first before opening the phone lines. Again, a reminder, if you do have questions that you'd like to submit online, please click the question mark button on your screen and follow the prompts. Charlie, we've got a question from a friend of yours. Of course, everybody is a friend of Charlie's. This is from Catherine in Georgia, who works with... Well, I wasn't going to name her by name, Charlie.
Oh, great.
Well, Catherine works with local governments in Georgia to promote environmental compliance with stormwater regulations and watershed protection. Catherine wants to know if you have any advice for how to use social marketing techniques to encourage local officials to fund and design stormwater management programs, especially in political climates where such actions are not the most popular thing in the world.
Very good question. Hi, Catherine. How are you? Yeah, and this is where the, quote, rain tax has been very unpopular. And voluntary techniques do tend to work better. For this, what we found with stormwater is the local officials respond to their constituents, which are the public, the voters. And we found that we've needed to educate the voters as to why they need to fund these programs. And it's a national problem. So that this is that beginning of the knowledge and awareness that is going to need to take years. And I know Fairfax County, they've been doing this for quite a while. So that if the voters understand that if they perhaps have to pay $5 a month more, this is why they're this is the benefit they're going to get if you ask them to pay more. And then, frankly, the local officials, we found, if the political will is there, they respond to them. Thanks, Catherine.
Great. And kind of sticking on the local ordinance line of things, Elaine from New York writes us and wants to know, are there any social marketing, or is there any social marketing work going on targeting construction site workers to help get them to properly conduct erosion and sediment control measures?
Hi there. Yes, there is, actually. And something that's very interesting, I think, about construction workers is that they are both, if you think of them, they're both employees, but they're also residents in communities. And so I know the city of San Diego has started an education program with all of their 10,000 employees who do inspections, who are out on the sites, and they have an employee recognition program that they have a weekly radio talk show where they highlight someone who has spotted something that either is going well, so there you get that positive recognition, and or not going so well, they don't cite the, you know, the name of the person, but it reinforces that they are the eyes and the ears, and they report back to the city, and that's actually been very successful.
Okay, Charlie, we're hearing from Michelle in Illinois, who apparently comes from a fairly small community in Illinois, and she was intrigued by your case study from Albuquerque and wants to know about the costs for putting such a program together. Michelle seems to think that the cost for these things might be a bit difficult for smaller communities to handle and to manage the program as far as tracking hours, doing the administrative work, and tracking and verifying participants. Any thoughts on that?
Yes, actually, thanks, Michelle. What it ultimately comes down to, for example, with the city of Albuquerque, is economics. They did not do this water conservation program because they thought it was a neat idea. They did it because they were running out of water, and it was going to be a lot more expensive for them to bring water in from the outside or to build additional reservoirs. So the municipality actually paid for it. So in your community, I know you say you're in a small community, if you can show that economically it's going to save them money. I mean, basically, you have to do social marketing within your organization to show them that it's going to save them money over the long term by promoting these low-flow toilets and water conservation measures now.
Thanks, Charlie. Keep those questions coming. We will now go ahead and unmute the phones and take questions from the phone lines.
Please introduce yourself, and when acknowledged, ask the question. I'm sorry,
folks. I pushed the wrong button. Let's try that again. If you have any questions, please introduce yourself and tell us your question.
Hi, this is Nancy Zabotowski from Kalispell.
I'm sorry, speaker. Could you speak up, please?
Nancy Zabotowski from Kalispell.
Yes, Nancy. Go ahead with your question.
So, Charlie, you focused on early adoption with this. I was wondering, like, after early adoption, do you just expect others to buy into it from peer pressure, or do you reevaluate and change your message to reach the others?
The question was related to early adoption and the follow-up necessary, if any, to get others to adopt as well.
Thanks, Nancy. Hello, Kalispell, Montana. That's a good question, and it depends on your budget. Basically, you want to get the most bang for your buck, so you want to target those, you know, the people whose behaviors you think you can change. But also, I agree with you that by social norms, if you can get, you know, most people to buy in, sometimes you are never going to get some of these people to change their behavior, so it's really not worth your time trying to focus on them. But you may want to talk to that audience, and it depends what kind of impact they're having on, you know, that you see in the environment, that if you feel you need to go after them, to then talk to them and see if you can match a benefit to them to get them to change their eyes. So I'm not saying ignore them completely, but it's a kind of a hierarchy of what to go after first.
Thank you. I have a question.
Yes, go ahead, speaker.
Hi, I'm calling from City of Salem in Oregon, and I'm wondering if there's examples of municipalities using system development charges as an incentive program.
Caller, could you explain what those are, please?
Well, for instance, when a developer comes in and gets permits and is charged system development charges, is charged fees for their development, are there examples of other municipalities doing reductions in these in order to get the developer to, say, conserve trees on the site or preserve areas along creeks, things like that?
That's a really great idea. No, I'm not aware of any municipalities. I'm looking to all our experts in the room. They all have that glassy-eyed stare.
I know that Portland, the city of Portland, has some, but I'm wondering if anybody else has heard of any other cities doing that.
I don't know. Maybe someone else can chime in. So the city of Portland does that. I'm not aware of any right now. Arlington County, apparently, for on-site stormwater management.
Yeah, usually.
The city of Chicago also has an expedited permit process for development.
It's a
new program, which is, I mean, I think Chicago might be the first major metropolitan city to do anything like it. But basically, if you're meeting certain kind of, basically, if you have a LEED certified building, they'll expedite the permit process in less than 30 days. And time is money for developers. So while it's not exactly a monetary incentive, it's pretty similar to it.
Oh. Yeah, and this is from Region 4. That's pretty much the standard, because impact fees are frowned upon a lot, but if you can help the developer by expediting their process and getting them through a lot faster, they'll go for it.
Okay, great. Any other questions from the phone lines? Okay. Let's go back to email. We are hearing from Alexia in Argentina. I think we just set a record for the question submitted from the furthest away. Hawaii was in the lead, I believe, but now we've moved international. And Charlie, Alexia wants to know if you have any examples regarding forest fire prevention, especially those caused by negligence.
Hi, Alexia. Are you in Buenos Aires? Yes, you are. I don't. I'm trying to think, well, there's the Smokey the Bear campaign, and the U.S. Forest Service, I have your email, so I can email you that link, because that's a very popular campaign, very old, and that's where their message is, only you can prevent forest fires. So again, it's that kind of personal responsibility. So I will go ahead and send that to you. Thank you very much.
Got another email from Lynn in Boston, who wants to know, because the federal government agencies are under stricter rules related to conducting surveys, do you have any advice on how the federal government can do the appropriate target audience research besides using existing data from other organizations?
That's a good question. There are a lot of universities that have social kind of social sciences departments that for projects do surveys, and maybe if you can latch on to one of them, you can get also some free research done, and so that it wouldn't be under the federal government restrictions. That is a definite issue and problem.
They keep coming in, Charlie. Deborah from Montana wants to know, how do you measure success for programs that have no point of sale? For example, the example that you showed for climbing stairs and heart health.
Hi, Deborah. That would be a very difficult one. What I would imagine is that poster is part of a larger campaign that has other facets to it, because that one doesn't have, for example, in some of our billboards, we have a hotline, or for more information, you know, call this number so we can track it that way. That's just kind of a one-way message for that initial knowledge. But when moving further into the behavior change, you would get, I think, more specific activities that you would look for. I mean, basically, you'd have to just weigh people before and after, which probably wouldn't be very popular.
Unless it was a reality show. Okay, we'll do one more question. Charlie, Marlene in Kansas points out that most of your examples and experience seem to be with urban environments and urban populations. Have you had any experience with rural populations, especially farmers and livestock owners? And Marlene is thinking specifically about bacteria and nutrient contamination of streams from livestock and or fertilizers.
Hi, Marlene. Yes, good question. And we have actually worked with farmers a lot, and we've got in the Getting in Step series, which is on the resource list, the video, we've got an example up in Pennsylvania, Mill Creek, where the issue was bacterial contamination from cows in the stream. And what worked there was a social marketing approach, because it was voluntary cooperation among the Amish farmers. And what worked there was a combination of techniques, peer pressure. You get one farmer who kind of buys into it, sees the benefits, and then they are the one to spread the message around to other farmers. We did quite a bit of cost share so that we gave them the skills to build the fences. We used Future Farmers of America kids to build the fences, so actually do the labor. We also worked with the conservation district, worked with veterinarians to be the ones to deliver the message to keep the cows out of the stream for the herd health. So we used the health issue for the cows. And we also, they worked with the women, the Amish women, who were very interested in wildflowers and birding. And so by fencing off the stream banks, it provided habitat that they were very interested in. So I encourage you to take a look at that video to see some of those examples, because there were a lot of different techniques rolled into one. Thank you very much.
Great, and thank you, Charlie. Just one follow-up to a previous question, the question of Argentina related to fire suppression. We did get an email from Deborah in Oregon, and Deborah, thank you for that. But Deborah points out that they have found that the fire danger, fire probability indicator, which if you're not aware of, it's kind of a clock, if you will, that shows an arrow pointing to whether or not fire danger is low on this particular day to medium to high. Deborah has found that those signs have been effective, and so that might be something else for you folks to consider in Argentina. With that, I'd now like to turn the microphone over to Chris Connor, who is Director of Communications for the Chesapeake Bay Program. Chris is going to talk to us about a social marketing in action, the Chesapeake Club campaign, which was developed in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We are now on slide number 51, Chris's first slide. Have at it, Chris.
Thanks, Ron, and thanks for everybody for taking some time out of their busy days today to learn a little bit about social marketing. What we're going to do here today about the Chesapeake Club Initiative is walk people through a little bit of the background of how we how the campaign evolved and why we chose to do the things that we did. We'll talk a little bit about the research of some of the information that we used to make sure that we were creating effective messages that were reaching our target audiences. Then walk folks a little bit through the campaign itself. And one of the things that I was coming out of Charlie's presentations and thinking about is a lot of people equate social marketing with television campaigns or media campaigns. It can be more than that, though. It's a way of communicating to your target audiences in a way that they can understand, relate to, and want to be part of. Sometimes it is TV. Other times it may be advertisements. But it can be as simple as small door-to-door campaigns. You don't need a huge budget to really put social marketing techniques to use. And then finally, as we go through this, I'm going to give you guys a lot of lessons learned. As we went through developing this campaign over a couple of years, we figured out a lot of things that were kind of, no pun intended, watershed moments. Times when we figured out, wow, if we would have only have known this before, we could have done a lot of things different. So thank you guys for joining us, and I guess right now we'll switch over to slide number 52. First off, Chesapeake Bay, for those of you who aren't too familiar with it, is the nation's largest estuary. It takes over a part of the mid-Atlantic states, about 64,000 square miles. So we have a lot of land and a lot of people to work with. The Chesapeake Bay watershed itself is parts of six states and all of the District of Columbia. And along with that large watershed, the bay itself has a very small volume of water. Of all the estuaries in the world, it has the highest watershed land to water volume ratio of any estuary in the world. So we've got a lot of problems to look at. One thing with Chesapeake Bay, a good way to think about it, is that Chesapeake Bay is a small puddle at the bottom of a very big hill. However we treat that land on the side of the hill is going to determine how clear that water is in the puddle. Right now, also in Chesapeake Bay, we have a rapidly growing population. There's some 16 million people that live on the land that drains into the bay, and that's going to be growing up to 18 million in the next 20 years. So with that, we have a lot of non-point source pollution, whether it's runoff from agricultural fields, city streets, rooftops, or even our own backyards. Each one of these little things plays a big role in the health of our local waters. So that's why one reason with this campaign, we really wanted to look at what individual actions can we try to impact to help clean up our local waters. And one thing right now, for those of you who are on the East Coast, you do hear a lot about runoff pollution. We've just gone through 3 or 4 days of huge, heavy rains here, and the flashiness of the Bay watershed, we're going to see the results of that in the next few days. We've gotten a little look out there, and it looks like Nesquik out there this morning, and that's not going to be good for those rockfish, the crabs, and the oysters that call Chesapeake Bay home. It's a little bit about the Bay watershed. Moving on to slide number 53, I just want to give folks an idea of what is going on to help Chesapeake Bay. For 20 years, the Chesapeake Bay Program Partnership, which is kind of a coalition of the federal government and the Bay states, and also academic organizations, conservation groups, has been working to really improve 5 key areas for Chesapeake Bay. And one of the things you'll find with our social marketing campaign, we're hitting a lot of these areas with this. First, we want to improve the water quality. Chesapeake Bay sees a lot of problems with dissolved oxygen levels and water clarity, probably very similar to what a lot of people are seeing in their local watersheds. As well, we've also got to improve those aquatic habitats, and Chesapeake Bay is very shallow. And what that means, it's a very productive ecosystem, but it's also one that we need to make sure we keep in balance. As well, as a lot of problems dealing with the way we manage watershed lands. However we treat the watershed is how the water is eventually going to look, as well as making sure we have sound fisheries management. And a really big area for us has been fostering Chesapeake stewardship. the idea that the more people can understand and care about the health of the Chesapeake Bay and their local waters, the more they're going to want to do to help it out. So if you want to find out more, there's a web link there that can give you a good idea of how is the bay doing and what's being done to restore it. Now moving to slide 54, a little bit more background about the Chesapeake Club campaign. Chesapeake Club was actually developed through a partnership with the Academy for Educational Development. They're a nonprofit in Washington, D.C., and they do a lot of work with their Center for Social Marketing and Behavior Change. So if you guys are looking at doing some campaigns, there's some great folks to work with. We've really enjoyed it. As well as the funding for our campaign, and being all environmental folks, we all know how important it is to recognize the folks who allow us to do what we do. Funding for our campaign came from the Commonwealth of Virginia, the District of Columbia, and EPA's Chesapeake Bay Program. And as we go through this presentation, another thing to look at, and you'll find this out about social marketing, is really looking at how do you want to be perceived by your target audiences. And one of the big things we've done here is we've branded this campaign as Chesapeake Club. This is the last time in this presentation you're going to see either a Chesapeake Bay Program logo or Academy for Educational Development logo, or an EPA logo, or a state logo. The idea behind that, and study after study shows us, that people tend to trust folks like themselves, not always the government. So it's a good thing to look at when doing social marketing campaigns is who is your messenger, and how are you being received? Moving on to slide number 55. We are looking at a couple of the key goals of the Chesapeake Club campaign. Coming into our campaign, we wanted to accomplish three main things. And what led us down this road is a lot of the research that we've done, and I can get into a little bit about that. Charlie did a great job in her presentation about talking about the information that you're bringing into a social marketing campaign. How are you basing your decisions? How are you picking your target audiences? And really, what is going to be those clear, simple messages that we need to get across to our folks? And what we've decided here with Chesapeake Club is three primary goals. The first thing that our research showed us is we wanted to talk to folks about fertilizer use. As I mentioned earlier, nutrient pollution is a very big problem here in Chesapeake Bay. With three-quarters of the runoff of the nutrient pollution coming from runoff, we have to figure out how can we reduce those levels. One of the things we looked at was home fertilizer use. In the Bay watershed, only about 6% watershed-wide of the nitrogen flowing into our streams and rivers comes from residential fertilizer use. But in other areas, it can be twice that. And that's one of the reasons we chose the Washington, D.C. area to use as our pilot area for the project. Almost 15%, in fact, about 12% of the nitrogen flowing into our local waters here is coming from residential fertilizer use. So what we're doing is we're looking at the problems facing the bay, looking at the folks who can impact that being residential homeowners, and developing messages and a communications campaign that's going to reach them and let them know what they can do. Another goal of the campaign was really creating that greater understanding of how my personal choices can impact the bay. And this is a personal stewardship message. For those of you working on community watershed programs, this is a big thing. It comes from the idea that people will always learn, I mean, they will always try to protect what they love, and they love what they understand. And it's up to us as communicators to help them understand their role in our environmental issues. And finally, another goal for our campaign was we wanted to bring new audiences to bay restoration. For more than 20 years, we've done a lot of outreach in the bay watershed, and you're also seeing it nationwide, where we're trying to tell people what needs to be done to help our critical resources. The problem is, a lot of times, we continue talking to the same people. And what Chesapeake Club was about from the beginning, it was really trying to look at broadening our congregation, not just preaching to the choir. And that's something we're all guilty of many, many times. And right now we'll swing over to slide number 56 and a little bit more about Chesapeake Club and a little bit why it's different than what we've done in the past. And a lot of that comes from really this idea of social marketing that Charlie talked about. Social marketing really is becoming a best management practice in terms of watershed restoration. if we can find more effective ways to engage people and have them doing the right thing, the better off our local water quality can be. And it's a huge thing. What we've done here with Chesapeake Club, instead of focusing on the environmental messages only, we've actually tried to broaden it out. What we want to try to do, we wanted to connect people with the desire of using the bay for recreation. It's fun. That's one of the key things we need to get across. Too many times for environmental issues, we're very doom and gloom, and that doesn't always sell with a lot of folks. So what we want to do is broaden out our message. Let's be inclusive. Let's find things that are good about our local environment that can bring people to the table and help them become part of the solution. Second, we also want to use for Chesapeake Club and promote the bay as an urban getaway. Our target audience for this campaign was residential homeowners in the Washington, D.C. area. It's a very urban type of folks. So what we want to find and what our research showed us is this is a target group of people that would love to kind of get away from urban life, get out on the bay, get out in our natural areas and experience them. It reduces stress, and hey, it's not a bad way to spend a weekend. Finally, the campaign actually used its research to decide to capitalize on the Mid-Atlantic region's love of its seafood. And it's a big thing, and this is something that I think we're challenged with in terms of environmental restoration, is finding ways that the public can get benefits from what we're doing other than we have, quote-unquote, a clean environment. What we did with Chesapeake Club is we wanted to link people's personal actions to the environmental health and then tying that to something they love, which is their seafood. Many of us are very fortunate that we can get out and paddle our local water bodies or swim or boat or fish. But a lot of times, many people can only get a chance to experience the Chesapeake Bay when they go to a local restaurant and order up a dozen hard crabs or some crab imperial or crab cakes. And that connection is a strong connection. And Charlie got into that a little bit earlier when we were talking about what matters to people. And just as a good example, we look at the idea of people's concern over environmental health. Poll after poll will show us that the environment is at the top of a lot of people's list for concerns, but their daily choices and behaviors don't necessarily reflect that. And I love using myself as a really bad example of one of those folks. Doing environmental restoration, I know that gas guzzling SUVs and low mileage vehicles are not the way to go for having clean air. But about a year ago, we were looking to try to figure out what kind of car do we want. My wife settled, she wanted a big black SUV. This is a little personal problem, doing what I do. I probably shouldn't do that. But I'll tell you what I drove up to the webcast in today, and that was a big black SUV. Why? Because my personal choices and my home life actually ranked a little bit higher than the environmental choice of that. So it's something to think about. While people may want to do the right thing, we need to find ways to actually have their behaviors reflect that. I guess in my own defense, I will say we did get a Honda Pilot, which is the most fuel-efficient of the large SUVs, so it was kind of our middle range. Anyway, now moving on to slide number 57. The campaign itself is five key components for Chesapeake Club. What we wanted to do was not focus in one area, such as paid advertising, or focus on creating some brochures or creating handouts. What a good social marketing campaign will do many times is have a broad mix of media. So you're reaching people in different ways at different times. And by taking that type of an approach, you're going to be able to make the campaign look larger than it is. So what we'll do is we'll walk through what we did using some web content, as well as what we've done with local restaurants. And we'll talk a little bit how restaurants can be great messengers for carrying your message. We also wanted to work with the professional lawn care industry. Our pre-survey found us that about 16% of the Washington area homeowners use a residential lawn care service. So we said, hey, what can we do to reach those folks, to reach a larger portion of our target audience? And then also we'll get into some paid advertising and earned media, and earned media being coverage of the campaigns that we're all working on. It's a way to maximize your budget and more people can hear about what you're doing. Moving down to slide number 58, a little bit about the Chesapeake Club website. For those of you who are online, the additional resources section has links out to the Chesapeake Club website. And here's a little bit of a screenshot on slide number 58. But one of the things that you want to notice with this is we purposely have not tried to sell an environmental message with the Chesapeake Club website. The idea that folks want to find about the health of the Chesapeake Bay and its environment, they can go to other places like the Chesapeake Bay Program website at chesapeakebay.net. What Chesapeake Club tries to do is it looks at selling the Chesapeake Bay lifestyle because it's what people care about. Their home, their food, and their life. And it's similar to what Charlie mentioned earlier, that we all have our decision points and things that matter most to us. And a lot of folks care how their home is. They care about the food they eat. We love to eat good, tasty, healthy food. And also, a lot of folks want to make sure they have a balanced life that balances, you know, their job, their kids, and their recreation. Then we've decided to take an approach to do this. As well, one of the things you'll notice here, too, if you get a chance to go through ChesapeakeClub.org, you're not going to find terms like nutrient cycle or eutrophication, things that really reach out to our environmental community. What you are going to find is a way to have the quintessential Chesapeake crab feast, the way to have a balanced, healthy backyard, one that balances the health of the bay with the health of your lawn. And the idea being, let's bring people into our messages, into our movement, from the lifestyle, and while we're there, we'll teach them a little bit about the environment as well. And this was kind of one of those watershed moments for us in realizing that the decision-making ability of folks is what matters to them. You know, again, another watershed moment for us was realizing that the people we're trying to reach with this campaign are not us. They don't understand nutrient cycle and things like that, but they do understand they love tasty seafood. They love having a good life outside of work, and the environment is something that they do want to be part of when it's presented to them in the right way. If you get a chance, ChesapeakeClub.org will also give you some great ideas on how you can balance your lawn. It has a very southern living or a coastal living feel to it. It's a much different thing than we're used to, so it's worth checking out. Moving to slide number 59, we'll talk a little bit about the parts of the campaign that work with restaurants. Restaurants are great messengers for reaching your community. Everyone loves their chef, and everyone trusts their chef. So what we wanted to figure out is how can we tie people's love of seafood to something they're going to do in their regular life and kind of make the two mix. So what you're seeing on slide number 59 is some coasters that we distributed to Washington area restaurants, tagged with Save the Crabs, Then Eat Them. It's a little bit of a different approach than you may have had in other environmental campaigns. Where we would have gone with the Save the Crabs type of approach, you would have still reached that environmental audience who's been doing the right thing for 20 years. We need to put a little twist on it so we can bring in new people. The idea that we need to find ways that people care about their natural environment and want to do something to protect it. And again, as Charlie mentioned earlier, a very nice, simple message on the backside, telling folks to skip the fertilizer in the spring and wait till the fall. On slide 60, you'll get an idea of some of the work that we did with those restaurants. We had more than 50 Washington area restaurants supported us. We provided them over 27,000 coasters free of charge. That way they were able to get a personal benefit for themselves and then pass that on to their customers. And then one of the great things we did as well was doing a kickoff event using the chefs as the messengers. So local Washington area chefs were asking residents, skip the fertilizer this spring and wait until the fall. That way they're not being told by the government partnership doing this. It's really an idea that it's supporting our local communities. Slide number 61 talks a little bit about the lawn care side of this program. We worked with about 38 professional lawn care providers in the Washington area and found a way that they could offer their customers a bay-friendly fertilizer regime. We brought in experts from the agricultural side of the different bay states as well as the University of Maryland to make sure we could find what are some bay-friendly fertilizer recommendations that are going to make sure that we're minimizing the amount that is running off to our local streams and rivers and also are still going to provide folks with a healthy green lawn. And by doing that, we created a win-win-win situation. The bay wins because it's seeing less runoff. The lawn care providers win because they've created a premium product that they can charge what they wish for. And then third win is for the homeowner who feels that they're making an environmentally friendly decision and being able to do their part to help the bay, which is something we need to be doing. And on slide 62, you'll get an idea of some of the materials that we provided to our local lawn care companies who then pass them on to our customers. thus becoming the message for carrying across the smart fertilizing campaign. Slide number 63 talks a little bit about the paid advertising that we've done. One of the key things to our campaign, we chose early on not to rely on public service announcements to carry across the television spots for the ads. Reason being, we were not, by doing that, we weren't able to control which eyeballs we were reaching at which time of day. So what you want to do is making sure that you're spending your funds wisely and reaching the people that are part of your target audience. If you, again, look at the additional resources section, you can actually watch all three of these spots online. The first spot, Delicious, really takes a little bit of a flip on environmental issues where we're talking about what people can, what's the environmental situation we're seeing out there and how we can link that to people's everyday choices. One of the recommendations that we saw in research about doing outreach campaigns, and we've tried to implement here with Chesapeake Club, is taking kind of a lighthearted approach that had a simple message, and we've done that with all three ads. I urge you to check it out when you get a chance. In addition to television ads, on slide number 64, you'll see some of the print ads that we ran in Washington area papers. Then you'll notice the messaging as well. We're really talking about protecting the crab cakes, not protecting the crabs. Again, we're trying to reach that broader audience that isn't necessarily environmentally aware, and we're trying to give them that personal benefit that social marketing tries. On the ad on the left, you'll also notice that we've plugged all of our local lawn care providers. These are the companies who are working with us, and what we wanted to do was to make sure they were getting recognized for their contribution, but also it helped us get more people to take advantage of the Chesapeake Club lawn care campaign. And you'll also see the common theme throughout the ads with the graphic look and the text, and that's something that, a lot of campaigns will do so people can get an idea of, oh, I've seen that before in another venue. Sliding on to number slide 65, you'll also see some print advertisements that we did in Washington's Union Station. One of our target audiences, or the key target audience, was folks who do their own fertilization out in suburbs of Washington, D.C. Union Station provided us a great venue because every day 100,000 commuters come from the burbs into Washington, D.C. on their way to work, and a lot of them will pass this. And the idea here is we had that repetition of ads, whether they were on the train cars, in dioramas in the station, so as people walk by, they would see the different messages, and also looking at large banners that you just couldn't miss when you walk through the station. The idea here is you're trying to create a campaign that's larger than it really is, and it was very effective in reaching folks who did that. And for the entire month of March, we had bought all the advertising in Washington's Union Station. It's a pretty impressive way to do it. Moving on to slide number 66, you'll see a little bit smaller version of some of the key messages that we had in the Chesapeake Club campaign. Why the overall message, and you would see this repeated in the television, print ads, and also the other materials, was skip the fertilizer this spring and wait till the fall. One of the key things that we wanted to do was keep it very simple, and it's something Charlie talked about a little bit earlier. So what you're looking at is some of the key ads that were on Washington Metro's subway cars, as well as in the stations. And again, you'll notice the messaging is really tying in, trying to link your individual actions to the health of local waters, to the health of your seafood. It's giving people that perceived benefit that if I do the right thing, I'm going to have better and more high-quality Chesapeake Bay seafood. Plus, let's be honest, this is the fun part of the campaign. Everybody loves catchy ads. On slide number 67, you see a little bit of background about the earned media component of what we were trying to do. And the earned media component is really trying to get people talking about the campaign. That way you're able to take your investment that you've made on the print media and the outreach and have newspapers cover it for free. It's the greatest thing in the world. When ads are in newspapers are expensive as they are, you want to find ways to kind of get people talking. We had some really good media coverage where we had the Associated Press did a piece, as well as the LA Times, the Washington Post, and a number of other local venues. This was a key way of reaching the 4 million people that live in the greater Washington, D.C. area. In addition to that, we also really tried to work with local television stations to get the message out that, hey, you as an individual play a role in the health of your local waters, and it's as easy as skipping the fertilizer this spring and wait until the fall. And as we went through the campaign, we used a lot of our partners as the messengers. We had local lawn care providers doing the interviews with television, not folks from government, but the folks who are out there actually taking care of your lawn, because that's who homeowners tend to trust. There was also some work done in Social Marketing Quarterly, where we've actually looked at the campaign and gone through the results and given a lot of the lessons learned similar to what we're talking about today. Moving on to slide number 68, we also made an outreach effort to folks through bumper stickers and window stickers and things like that in order to really get the campaign in different areas. So if you happen to miss a TV ad, which was hard for the month of March last year, you could actually have folks with the Save the Crabs, They Need Them bumper stickers. You would also see folks at metro stations handing out the coasters as an outreach device. The coasters worked really well because you weren't giving someone a brochure. You were giving them something that made them think. It was a different way of reaching them, and it was more memorable. And then finally, we made an outreach effort to really hit bloggers, and this is something that you'll be seeing more and more in marketing efforts now. A lot of us out there read blogs every day. We tend to migrate to things we care about, and you hear more folks talking about them. And it's becoming a more and more effective outreach technique to getting to folks who blog in the same way you try to get to newspapers, because they reach a large audience. And you'll see an example of the bumper sticker there on slide number 68. And finally, slide number 69 goes a little bit of a new addition we made for 2006. When we did our campaign, we had a number of folks come to the website, but what we wanted to do was really raise those numbers. So we actually created some computer animation working with some folks who are very good at this to try to drive folks to the website. And it's actually something we created called Crab Kwon Do. It's a little bit different, a little bit edgy, and you may look at it and say, what is that? But that's the whole idea. By doing that, we're then trying to drive people to the Chesapeake Club website to find out more and find out, where did this thing come from? So when you get a few minutes after the presentation, check out Crab Kwon Do and let us know what you think. Well, I guess we're at a good point right now to take some questions, and we'll have Ron, our moderator, handle that.
Thanks, Chris. Chris, we're hearing from a lot of folks, actually, and the first question comes from Linda in Washington State, who wants to know a little bit more about how you identified your target audience for fertilizer reduction.
Sure. Thank you very much. Fertilizer reduction is our target audience. Really came from some pre-survey work we did before the campaign. A year before we launched, as we were going through the campaign development phase, we wanted to figure out what easy actions can we do and how can we find the right folks to tell them the right thing to do. We did about a 600-person random telephone survey of the Washington area, and we asked folks about their knowledges, their attitudes, their behavior towards Chesapeake Bay restoration, and ask them also some of the smaller things they may do in their daily life that can be used to help modify that behavior to see environmental gain. And one of the things we found, we had a lot of folks in the Washington area that regularly applied fertilizers, did it multiple times a year, and what we found by combining that with research done by a lot of the universities is that they generally over-applied fertilizer. And one of the key things we wanted to do with this campaign is look at how can we shift the timing and encourage people to apply fertilizer correctly. The science tells us we can't say don't fertilize because some fertilizer is good for lawns. So to be true to the science, we had to look at modifying the timing. So between the random telephone survey that gave us a good idea of what people are doing, we also leveraged that with a little bit of research where we would spend a Saturday morning out at Home Depot kind of talking to folks who are buying fertilizer. And, I don't know how to do it, so I happened to ask the guy next to me who was trying to pick out his fertilizer, and they would give us ideas, well, you know, I saw an ad for this, or I used this for the last 20 years, it's always worked fine. And it was really a mix of that qualitative research and the quantitative research to really hit our targeted audiences. As well, the surveys also showed us that predominantly the folks who were fertilizing most often were adults 35 to 54, and that was who we chose as our target audience for the campaign.
Great. Thanks, Chris. And real quick question for you. I'm combining some questions here. Who created your ad campaign, your slogans, and how much did it cost?
Sure. Our campaign, the Chesapeake Club campaign, was developed by the Chesapeake Bay Program, working closely with the Academy for Educational Development, We mentioned them earlier in the presentation. AED has done a lot of social marketing and behavior change programs in the past. Folks who worked with our campaign have worked with the Truth Campaign down in Florida, which was anti-smoking. They also have done work with the Seatbelt Campaign that Charlie talked about earlier, as well as a number of commuter programs. They've got a great track record in communications programs and social marketing, so they were great to work with. And they really led a lot of the campaign development. We also work closely with trying to get some stakeholder buy-in coming into this to really narrow the realm of areas we wanted to study. And one of the social marketing principles that AED recommended and turned out to be right on was, let's find a behavior that's very public, that people see on a regular basis, that we can use social marketing principles to work on. And that's how lawn care fertilization came up. The campaign itself ran about $600,000, and I know that sounds like a lot of money, but Washington, D.C. is a very expensive media market. And when you go to paid advertising, you've got to make sure that cost is something you think of. We had actually looked in every couch and in every fund we could for the necessary money to pull this together, and actually had pulled together funds over three different years to do the campaign. We felt that doing the campaign without adequate funding was going to be a waste of money. We had to make sure we had the right amount of resources to get the job done.
Okay, thanks, Chris. In the interest of time, I'd like to forgo the phone questions right now. Sorry, phone folks, but we will get back to you in a few minutes. Let us move on to slide number 71, and Chris will now tell us about the evaluation of Chesapeake Club.
Thanks, Ron. So on slide number 71, it gives you a little bit of background about the survey work that we did. I mentioned earlier we did a pre-campaign survey, really setting up our baseline. So after we did the campaign, we could answer the question, were you effective at raising awareness? And more importantly, were you effective at changing behavior? And really, behavior change is the holy grail of outreach campaigns. Awareness is great, but behavior change is really what we're trying to strive for. So before the campaign, we did a 600-person telephone survey I mentioned earlier to try to get an idea. After the campaign, we fielded a similar survey with similar questions, so we could use that to give us a pre- and post-analysis of Washington area residents and their feelings and perceptions and uses of fertilizer and also Chesapeake Bay. So the pre- and post-survey was really our key tool to figure out how successful were we. On slide number 72, the first key result, we asked folks to say, hey, have you seen anything about fertilizer use or Chesapeake Bay in the last few months? And when we asked that question, we had a professional survey ask that question far more formally than I just did. But what we did find is that about 72% of Washington area residents surveyed had been able to identify part of the campaign, and that's just a really great awareness level from something that ran over about a 10-week period in the spring. Washington area, as I mentioned earlier, is about 4 million people. There's about 2 million households, so we were able to reach 72% of our target audience in that area, which is pretty critical for us in terms of reducing non-point source pollution. Slide number 73, you'll see another key result, and that was about 43%, or almost half of folks, were actually able to recall either the Chesapeake Club or the Save the Crabs and Eat 'Em. The idea there being that we had a memorable campaign. We communicated in a way that our target audience was able to recall it. It just wasn't yet another billboard they passed on their way to work or another TV ad as they were watching The Simpsons on Sunday night. It was something that they actually remembered. Slide number 74. We'll give you just a little bit of a comparison in terms of brand recognition. And branding is something critical to look at for campaigns. As it goes to that recall. Branding is a way of creating something that people want to become associated with. Scotts, for example, who spends, I think last year in the first half of the year, spent like $50 million nationwide on marketing and branding. They've got a brand recognition in the Washington area from our survey, about 3 out of every 4 people. You know, we're almost up to half, but we're coming on strong. So that's kind of our key message there. On slide number 75, we also asked folks a little bit of how do they feel about the brand. And again, that idea of branding is creating something that people want to really weave into their own lives. We're giving them something that they want to be part of. And we asked about the Save the Crabs and Eat 'Em. A lot of folks liked it, and it was really our way of resonating with a lot of folks. You'll also see there a little image of the Maryland Watermen's Gazette. Our Watermen's community loved the campaign because for one of the first times, we were talking about an issue in a way that they felt that they were being heard as well. and they had actually taken the brand and were running with it and doing coloring contests in their publications, really supporting what we were doing. So that was a great thing to see. It's really, it's the sign of you've got a brand that people want to be part of. Slide number 76, another one of the key results is people have retained what we asked them to do, which is a lot of times not something that happens with campaigns. But when people remember to do what you asked them, it's a sign that your messaging was clear and you found a way to communicate that mattered. We had almost about 2 out of every 5 folks remembered from seeing the ads that they should either wait until the fall or don't fertilize in the spring. The idea being there is people, they remember what they were doing. It wasn't like those commercials that you see and you're like, what the heck was that? But they actually remained what we were trying to do. Slide number 77 will actually give you an idea of the pre and post, and this is really one of the big things. As I mentioned earlier, our goal was not to tell people don't fertilize at all. But what we did see in the post-campaign analysis, before about 23%, after about 5% more of the Washington area residents surveyed were unlikely to fertilize. And while we were aiming for a shift in timing, we did see an increase in the folks not fertilizing at all. So there was a behavior change impact there. And on slide number 88, this was really our target action, was trying to get folks to skip the spring fertilizer and wait till the fall. We saw about a 4% bump in there. I will say that number is not statistically significant by a hair, but it does show that we are starting to move people in the right direction. And with repetitive campaigns, we really hope to be able to do that. So that brings us to slide number 79, and if folks had any questions.
Thanks, Chris. Very interesting campaign, and I hope, based on the questions and the feedback that we're getting, a lot of people are really excited about it. We do have a few minutes to answer additional questions. However, first let me draw again everyone's attention to where you can obtain the speaker's contact information. If you're online, simply click on the home button at the top of your screen. You'll be returned to the homepage, which has Charlie's and Chris's email address and phone number. At the bottom of the homepage, you'll find 2 additional items. One is a link to additional resources, which I mentioned at the beginning of today's session. Clicking this link will direct you to several useful watershed and wetland resources from EPA and other organizations. The second item at the bottom of the homepage is the seminar feedback form. Please consider completing this form as we do consider your comments while working to improve our webcast. Now we do have additional time for questions. We'll take the questions submitted online first, and then we'll go to the phones. Chris, first question comes from Jeff in Washington, who wants to know what's next for Chesapeake Club.
Thanks, Jeff. One of the things we're looking at for Chesapeake Club is really trying to figure out what other markets in the Bay watershed can we go to. We found that we've had a campaign that was based on some good research, had some good messages, and really resonated with our target audience. So we're going to be looking at what other areas can we take it to. You know, for example, Hampton Roads down in Virginia would be a great candidate because you have that linkage to the Chesapeake Bay, the linkage to its seafood, as well as Richmond, Virginia, Baltimore, Maryland. The one thing we do want to be careful with is when we look in other areas of the watershed, as we go up the Bay watershed, maybe Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, or Binghamton, New York, we'll need to change our message to reach folks in those areas of the upland parts of the watershed. And it really goes to show that we can't do the one-size-fits-all approach to outreach. We really need to tailor our messages to local communities so we can make sure we can reach people in a way that matters. We ran a little bit of a second year here in Washington, D.C. We ran some of the ads again, but also out on the horizon is other ways that we can reach people. There's a lot of things that folks can do to help the Bay. Lawn fertilizer is one, but as Charlie mentioned, you know, scooping the poop, fixing the way that we have manage some of our watershed lands. There's some really good opportunities out there.
Thanks, Chris. I think you're also the first presenter in this series who's mentioned bloggers, so I congratulate you for that. But we also have a question out of Missouri from Sam, who wants to know if you can tell us a little bit more about using blogs and viral marketing techniques. How do you reach the bloggers and get them to spread the word?
Reaching bloggers is one of those evolving fields in marketing, and it's a great question. We're still learning how to do it as well, but one of the things that we've done is you'll find in different issues you have certain bloggers that tend to follow issues, and one of the ideas is you kind of follow them, For example, on the Washington Post website, they tend to actually include blogs that are linking to articles on their website, and it's a good way we use to target folks we need to reach. The best methods we did were just kind of firing like little short emails, hey, we thought you might like this, we read something on your blog about it. And the idea of, again, you're trying to really broaden the number of people and the messengers who are helping carry your message. And bloggers are trusted. I mean, if you think about it, the idea of a successful blog is you have thousands or tens of thousands or maybe hundreds of people that want to come to your site every day to hear what you have to say. And that's because they trust you. So the idea of using blogs as a marketing technique is something that's evolving, but it's a great way to reach people through another trusted messenger.
Thanks, Chris. And now, as promised, let's go to the phone. Anybody on the phone line have a question for Chris? Or Charlie, for that matter? No questions from the phones? One more question, Chris, that was submitted online. This came from Jennifer, also in Washington State. Wants to know a little bit more about how the earned media was earned. For example, press releases, direct contact with reporters, dinner. Maybe you could elaborate on that.
You know, if we are trying to get people to save the crabs, I think dinner would be a fine idea. But no, the earned media part of the campaign, we really took a bit of a traditional approach, but then threw in a couple kind of curveballs out there. When we launched our campaign, we, of course, did the standard press release saying, you know, we're trying to reach people in a new way. And a lot of our messaging focused on the kind of social marketing aspect of Chesapeake Club, the idea that this is a new and innovative way of reaching people about the health of the Bay. So we did press releases. We did a kickoff event in which we had 7 Washington area chefs, some of the better-known folks in the area, come to a seafood restaurant in the DuPont Circle area of D.C. We invited media out. We had some television cameras. We had the Washington Post come out. And the idea being that the chefs were being the messengers. They were carrying that message that homeowners need to do the right thing to help the Bay. And it also gave some great visuals. We had some chefs whip up some Chesapeake Bay culinary treats that actually I think some of the reporters got a chance to sample. But the idea there, again, linking the health of the seafood to the health of the resource. We also really tried to push our partners as the messengers. When we were working with local television stations, we didn't want to have them talk to us. We wanted to have them talk to our partner organizations who are out there changing the way they were fertilizing residents' lawn and showing people why it matters. And that really kind of goes to the idea of a campaign being kind of a focus of the community, not just of the organization putting it on.
Great. Thanks, Chris. At this time, I'd like to conclude today's webcast. I'd like to especially thank Charlie McPherson and Chris Connor for presenting today. And, of course, thanks to everyone who joined us. Please visit EPA's Watershed Discussion Forum at www.epa.gov/watershedforum. Go to that website to discuss more issues related to this topic. We also encourage folks to return to www.epa.gov/watershedwebcasts. Go to that website for notices about upcoming webcasts as part of Watershed Academy. Our next webcast will be July 19th. We'll hear from Pat Bradley of EPA's Water Permits Division and Bob Seidel of the City of Richmond, Virginia. Pat and Bob will give a presentation tentatively titled Benefits of Watershed-Based NPDES Permitting. Pat and Bob will explain how watershed-based permitting under the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System program can lead to better watershed-based decisions and improved water quality. So please mark your calendars for this intriguing webcast, July 19th. Registration for the webcast will open on the Watershed Academy website on July 12th. That ends our webcast for today. Thank you very much.